From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, more violence in the Sinai, extended voting in Nigeria, tackling the crisis in Iraq, the evolving U.S.-Cuba relationship, plus a peek at Apple's new smartwatch. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Two attacks in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula Sunday killed at least 13 people, wounding dozens more. At least seven people died when a car bomb was detonated near a police station in the El Arish capital of North Sinai. In a separate attack, at least six soldiers were killed when a roadside bomb was set off as an armored military vehicle passed near Sheikh Zawed. A group called Ansar Beit al-Maqdis, which claims responsibility and loyalty to the Islamic State, claim responsibility for that attack. And now we go to Kenya. Sleeping students there awakened by a blast at the University of Nairobi's Kikuyu campus early Sunday, panicked as they tried to escape when they believed there was a terrorist attack underway. One student was killed and as many as 150 injured. Some students jumped from upper-story windows, the blast caused by an overloaded electrical cable.
We had an hitch with the electricity, and then because we understand on the situation of the country, students took it like it was an attack, and that's why we had the panic.
Evanston Gitonto is a student on campus. A fellow student, Eddie Kapara, was glad to have escaped uninjured.
Bearing in mind the Garissa attack, students thought that, again, it was another attack from Al-Shabaab, but the actual thing, it was a fire breakout. So people left the hall in various ways, some through the window from sixth floor to ground floor. But I'm glad I escaped the situation.
Sunday's incident follows the April 2nd attack by Al-Shabaab on Garissa University College in Kenya's northeast, where nearly 150 students were massacred. At the same time, the Kenyan government has asked the UN High Commission for Refugees to relocate hundreds of thousands of Somali refugees from the Dadaab camp in eastern Kenya by July in the wake of this month's militant attack. The government says the camp has become a recruitment center for extremist groups. Deputy President William Ruto, in a statement, said the way America changed after 9/11 is the way Kenya will change after Garissa. Gunmen firing from a passing vehicle opened fire on the South Korean embassy early Sunday in the Libyan capital Tripoli, killing two security guards. No Korean embassy workers were hurt. Militants claiming loyalty to the Islamic State group said they were behind the attack. Libya has been plagued with terrorism, violence, and political chaos since dictator Muammar Gaddafi was toppled and killed in 2011. Islamists have seized the capital, Tripoli, and set up a separate government, forcing the internationally recognized government to flee to the east. Meantime, Western diplomats are welcoming the resumption of UN-sponsored peace talks in Algeria today. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his British, French, German, Italian, and Spanish counterparts issued a joint statement urging all parties to negotiate in good faith, form a unity government, a national government, and work for an unconditional ceasefire. They also threatened sanctions against anyone who undermines Libya's political transition. Two Malian soldiers were killed. It happened Sunday when their military vehicle detonated a landmine. At least three other people were wounded. That incident occurred near the town of Diabali, about 500 kilometers north of the capital Bamako. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. Comes as the government tries to forge a peace agreement with the separatist Tuareg rebels in the north. French-led intervention pushed jihadi groups from control of the north in early 2013. Remnants of those groups have been blamed for a series of attacks aimed at soldiers and UN peacekeepers. And we turn to Nigeria. The election commission there says the party of President-elect Muhammadu Buhari maintained power in the Lagos state governorship following his stunning election victory over President Goodluck Jonathan on March 28. Regional voting was extended in several states following violence in which at least nine people were killed on Saturday. Allegations of voting irregularities there. Voters were electing 36 state governors, with 29 of the races contested. Turnout appeared to be weaker than in the presidential vote, when Mr. Jonathan became the first head of state voted out of office in a peaceful change of power. Mr. Buhari will be sworn in on May 29th. Analysts view this victory as a vote of no confidence in the way Mr. Jonathan was handling a bloody insurgency by the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. The group is believed to have killed 15,000 people since 2009 in its bid to create an Islamic caliphate in the northeast. Boko Haram also abducted more than 200 schoolgirls a year ago, and more than 100 members of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign gathered Sunday in Abuja. They were holding a prayer session. Among those attending was Maureen Kabrick.
So for us, this is a very significant event as we commit our activities into the hands of God and ask for his mercy and plead that he also help to intervene in the issue of our Chibok girls.
Also part of that was Usman Shehu.
We have tried the physical aspect. We also need to bring in the supernatural aspect. And so for both Muslims and Christians, this is an opportunity for us to reconnect with God, to ask for God to give us the empowerment to be able to continue with the advocacy, and if possible, to have a divine intervention that will enable the girls to be brought back as quickly as possible.
The Bring Back Our Girls organization plans a series of events this week leading up to the April 14th anniversary of the mass abduction from Chibok State in Borno State, that is. The fate of the girls still remains a mystery. Sudanese will cast votes today in elections being boycotted by the opposition in a ballot expected to extend the rule of President Omar Hassan al-Bashir, who has led the country for more than 25 years. The presidential and parliamentary elections are to take place over 3 days and are the first since South Sudan became independent in 2011. Opposition says a clampdown on their members, the media, and civil society has created an impossible environment to challenge Mr. Bashir, who came to power in a coup in 1989. Mr. Bashir is wanted by the International Criminal Court on allegations of orchestrating genocide during the Darfur conflict, which left hundreds of thousands dead and millions displaced.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Video distributed by activists appear to show the sad state of affairs in Yarmouk refugee camp in Syria. It has suffered a week of shelling and fighting between the Syrian regime, local opposition fighters, and Islamic State forces, which have seized most of the camp. International Committee of the Red Cross says emergency medical care is desperately needed, and the United Nations says it wants to work with the Syrian government to ensure the safety of Palestinians and Syrians both inside and outside the camp. Ramzi Ezzedin is deputy to the UN envoy to Syria.
The situation in the camps is our special case, and we need to address it as soon as possible. So we have agreed that we will work together based on what Syria has done over the years and try to intensify this cooperation so that we can address the ongoing tragedy.
The United Nations says more than 18,000 people were in the Yarmouk camp when the Islamic State militants took over the camp last week. Nuseiba Yunus, with the Project on Middle East Democracy, is focusing her research on Iraqi politics and the rise of the Islamic State militants, sometimes called ISIL, often called ISIS or Daesh, as it's known in Arabic. She's just returned to the United States from Iraq and spoke on VOA's Press Conference USA with host Carol Castiel.
I spoke to a number of influential Sunni leaders on my trip, both in Iraq but also in Qatar and in Turkey. And something that really unifies these voices is a sense that the Iraqi government, though Prime Minister Abadi is well-intentioned, is simply not delivering on its promises to really reform Iraqi politics so that Iraqi Sunnis feel that they have a real stake in the future of Iraq and feel that their future in Iraq is protected. And ultimately, as much as we hear about these small Sunni tribal forces joining the fight in Tikrit, for instance, or in other instances, these are tiny, tiny numbers. When we look at the Sahwa back in 2007...
The so-called awakening.
Yeah, the awakening movement, which is when the United States empowered Sunni tribes to fight al-Qaeda in Iraq. There we're talking about over 100,000 Iraqi Sunnis taking up arms against al-Qaeda, and that was successful. And now we're seeing maybe something in the region of 5,000. I mean, the numbers are really a fraction of what we've seen before. And the underlying grievances of Iraq's Sunni population have not yet been effectively or credibly addressed. And the longer that the Abadi government goes on without addressing those core grievances, the more he loses the credibility and the goodwill that he had built up when he replaced Prime Minister Maliki. And I think this is really a subject of the utmost urgency and is really missing from the way in which we talk about the success of our forces defeating ISIL here in the United States.
How do you define the Sunni grievances?
Well, I mean, there are so many, but the core grievances really relate to the imprisonment, arrest, torture, and conviction of Iraqi Sunnis on terrorist charges without due process. So it's a bit of a vicious circle, really, in that you have terrorism emerging from the Sunni community, and then you have Shiite-dominated Iraqi forces going into Sunni towns and villages and just doing these random sweeps in which they arrest a bunch of Sunni men, or when they can't find the men they're looking for, they'll arrest some women who are related to them. And the Iraqi judicial system really relies on confession. I mean, they don't make any attempt to do forensic examinations. They don't do serious investigations. They basically torture people into confessing. And so you end up with thousands of wrongly convicted Sunnis in prison or even on death row on terrorism charges who have had nothing to do with any terrorist activity. And that fuels such a sense of being unfairly targeted, of being the subject of a witch hunt, and of Sunnis really feeling vulnerable and unsafe around Iraqi security forces. And that's one of the core grievances that Sunnis talked about again and again when you had these mass Sunni protests in 2013. And the Iraqi government has ultimately done very little to address this.
Based on your conversations with members of government over there in Iraq, first, does Prime Minister al-Abadi recognize these grievances, and does he recognize that it's ultimately the political process which will defeat Daesh, ISIS, ISIL? And if so, what are the impediments at the Iraqi political level?
I think we're in actually quite a rare situation in Iraq where we have a progressive and genuinely visionary leader. I mean, Prime Minister Abadi, by all accounts, is aware of these grievances and has been trying to push reform through the cabinet and to introduce new legislation to the Iraqi parliament. The problem is that we have such a broken sense of community in Iraq and such tension between Iraq's Shiite and Sunni communities that we're seeing Shiite political leaders block any attempt to introduce these political reforms in parliament. And ultimately, these Shiite political leaders are representing Shiite constituencies who don't want to see any concessions given to Iraqi Sunnis. You know, they see these Sunnis often as terrorists, as people responsible for the mass murder of their sons, who've been involved in fighting Daesh. And the idea that you give these people concessions at a time like this when emotions are really heightened, I mean, it's unpalatable and it's very politically challenging. And it would require these political leaders to really follow a long-term vision for how Iraq can actually be repaired at the expense of potentially their short-term political popularity and success.
That was Nusseibeh Yunus. She is with the Project on Middle East Democracy, speaking here with VOA's Carol Castiel, host of the program Press Conference USA. You can hear more of their conversation by going to our website, voanews.com, and look for Press Conference USA under the Programs tab. President Obama back here in Washington following a historic face-to-face meeting with Cuban President Raul Castro. All of that on the sidelines at the Summit of the Americas in Panama, where Cuba participated for the first time. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez reporting from Panama City.
It was a much-anticipated encounter between leaders of two nations that have been enemies for more than a half century. President Barack Obama spoke first.
This is obviously a historic meeting. The history between the United States and Cuba is obviously complicated, and over the years, a lot of mistrust has developed.
But Mr. Obama said it is time to turn the page, try something new, and start engaging Cuba. At the same time, he said the U.S. recognizes differences will exist between the two governments. Raul Castro said that fundamentally what President Obama expressed reflects the same as what the Cubans are thinking. The Cuban leader said his government is willing to discuss everything, including human rights, if those discussions are respectful. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, Panama City.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and other Obama administration officials launching a new round of consultations with members of Congress this week on the Iran nuclear negotiations. Some lawmakers have been openly critical of a framework agreement reached earlier this month, saying the guidelines for lifting sanctions on Iran are unclear and that the plan does not provide enough assurances that Iran will not develop nuclear weapons. But Secretary Kerry backed up the plan during a series of TV appearances Sunday. We get more now from VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins.
Fresh from the Summit of the Americas in Panama, Kerry now turns his attention to Capitol Hill and lawmakers skeptical of an Iran nuclear deal.
I will let the final agreement speak for itself.
He urged congressional critics to hold their fire and wait for a final deal.
I think we've earned the right through what we've achieved in the interim agreement and what we have laid out in this parameter that has been set forth. We've earned the right to be able to try to complete this without interference and certainly without partisan politics.
On Tuesday, a Senate panel is expected to debate a highly contentious bill that would require the president to allow Congress to review an Iran nuclear agreement. The bill's co-sponsor, Senator Bob Menendez, vowed to keep up his fight.
To fight for our national security and against a nuclear-armed Iran, among other things, and that's what I have been doing, and that's what I will continue to do.
And the U.S. and other world powers involved in Iran nuclear talks also continue to deal with foreign skeptics, including Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who warned negotiators against making dangerous concessions to Iran.
We must not allow Iran, the former sponsor of global terrorism, to have an easy path to nuclear weapons, which will threaten the entire world.
Iran is seeking a deal that provides sanctions relief. World powers are seeking limits that will ensure Iran's nuclear program is peaceful. The stakes are high for the U.S. both domestically and internationally as negotiators try to reach an agreement before their end of June deadline. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
Casting herself as a champion of everyday Americans, former First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced Sunday she's running for president. In a video released on the internet and social media, people from all over the country spoke about their aspirations and what they hope to do with their lives in the days and the years ahead. And then Clinton spoke.
I'm getting ready to do something, too. I'm running for president. Americans have fought their way back from tough economic times, but the deck is still stacked in favor of those at the top. Everyday Americans need a champion, and I want to be that champion. So you can do more than just get by. You can get ahead and stay ahead. Because when families are strong, America is strong.
And Republican presidential contenders sounding off against the Clinton race. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul announced last week he's running for president and issued a video in part aimed at Clinton.
Hillary Clinton represents the worst of the Washington machine. The arrogance of power, corruption and cover-up, conflicts of interest, and failed leadership with tragic consequences.
Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz was one of the first in his party, in fact, was the first to announce for president. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush also is expected to soon make a bid for the Republican Party nomination for president. Both have made public comments about Clinton and how they believe she is not presidential material.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Well, that long-awaited Apple Watch is now on display for the first time at Apple's retail stores in several of the world's capitals. VOA's Adam Phillips caught up with some of the buzz at the company's store in New York.
New York's flagship Apple store is an icon of glass and chrome on Fifth Avenue and 59th Street, the center of one of the highest-end retail districts in the world. On Friday, it was also a magnet for an eager mob of iFans lined up several deep to try out the new Apple Watch and perhaps pre-order it. The device is crammed with hundreds of applications, so many that old-time Apple customers like Benny Abraham could only scratch their heads in a sort of dazed wonder.
I don't know what it does. What does it do? iPhone that's put into a watch? So it's a phone. Is it an accessory too? It seems pretty cool. How much is it? That's what I want to know. How much is it? Yeah, I want everything Apple has. If only I had, you know, a job, I'd be all right.
The Apple Watch comes in several models. At the lowest end, the sport version with stainless steel case and rubber wristband sells for a tidy $349. $17,000 will buy you an Apple Watch worked in 18-karat gold. But Mike Dean, a New Yorker formerly of Texas, isn't interested in the gizmo as jewelry.
I think the reason I'm drawn a bit to the Apple stuff is the way it all integrates together. For me, that's it. I've got the phone, the computer, and so now I'm going to take a look at the watch. So.
What do you think of it?
It was pretty nice, pretty nice.
You going to get one?
I don't know yet. Right now, there's such a long wait time if you order that it's easy enough just to be a little patient and see how things play out.
A fashionably dressed Vermonter named Robin says she and her husband actually own two technology companies. So she's intrigued by the product, both as a connoisseur and as a businesswoman.
Well, it's always neat to see new technology. You got to keep up with it. And also, I'm a shareholder since day one, so I like to see what happens.
Robin is waiting to pre-order the watch for now.
Oh, I'm never disappointed with Apple, even if there's glitches in it. The bottom line is that you know that the first one out of the box is going to have some issues. And then you're patient. You know, they'll upgrade the operating system, and that's fine. But it'll be a little buggy, and you just get past it.
10-year-old Emma seems eager to get one now. For her, it would mostly be something super cool to bring to school. Is there like a social aspect of it, too? So like if your friends see you have one?
Yeah, then they'll want one. Obviously going to want one if everybody else is getting one.
Does it make it seem like you're more important?
No, it's not really like that, because if you just get it, you're lucky. You're not, like, spoiled. You just get it.
Even traditionalists might enjoy the Apple Watch. It actually tells the time. For now, Apple has received back orders until June. As yet, there is no app that will predict the future. But Apple is hoping the product will outsell all other smartwatches on the market today combined. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
I'm pretty sure somebody's working on an app that will predict the future. Can't wait to find out what that'll be. Well, he finished second at last year's Masters Golf Tournament. This year, he's out on top. 21-year-old American Jordan Spieth looked a lot like Tiger Woods at the Masters 18 years ago on Sunday when he closed the tournament with a 2-under par 70 to match the tournament record low of 18-under, 270 for 72 holes. Woods achieved that mark when he clinched his maiden major title at the 1997 Masters when he was only 21. Spieth's playing partner, Justin Rose of England, the 2013 U.S. Open champion, signed off with a 70 to share second place with three times winner Phil Mickelson, who carded a 69. Things went from bad to worse, though, for Tiger Woods on Sunday when he appeared to jam his wrist and right shoulder on his second shot on the ninth hole, and he had some issues with a bone.
Just a bone kind of popped out, and the joint kind of, you know, went out of place, but I put it back in.
Put it back in, yeah. Despite the disappointing final round, Woods posted his best finish since 2013, a 5-under week that had led him to a tie of 17th at the end of the tournament. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Aydin Utku, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat.
The African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct.
And adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America. Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Even as the United States implements its new strategy for engagement in Central America, the Guatemalan, Salvadoran, and Honduran governments face economic and social challenges fueled by violence, corruption, and lack of economic opportunity. Last November, the presidents of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras launched the Plan of the Alliance for Prosperity in the Northern Triangle, an initiative to comprehensively improve their country's economic opportunity, governance, and public safety. While conditions in Central America remain challenging, the region could be close to transformative change. Last summer's spike in migration of unaccompanied children signaled that reform is required. With strong political will among the region's leaders, the U.S. is aligning our strategy and directing foreign assistance to support Central American partners as well as address the underlying causes of regional outbound migration. In implementing our new approach in Central America, the State Department, USAID, and other agencies will work to reduce levels of crime and violence. In order to sustain gains made on security issues, we will intensify joint efforts to expand education and job creation initiatives. Stronger, more accountable democratic institutions and thriving civil society organizations are key to improving security and providing opportunity. Working in this way shows the people of the region that we share responsibility to improve conditions. Community-based initiatives will be center stage. The Model Police Precincts program helps prevent crime by connecting police and the judicial system to the community. The Gang Resistance Education and Training program places police officers in schools to teach youth life skills and how to resist joining gangs. Youth outreach centers provide a safe space for at-risk youth to study and obtain job training linked to jobs that the private sector needs filled. These programs will create sustainable change. So, too, will reforms to strengthen judicial systems which help deliver accountable, transparent justice. Our mutual prosperity agenda for Central America, which will be reinforced at the Summit of the Americas, fosters the regional market integration of 43 million people and the reduction of legal impediments to equitable and sustainable growth. Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs Roberta Jacobson recently told Congress, "Now is the time for a new U.S. approach to Central America that prioritizes security, prosperity, and governance. We have a vision, we have a plan, and we want to work with Congress to help Central America and protect U.S. national security."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.